solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
I think it was Niels Bohr who said, the opposite of a simple truth is a falsehood. The opposite of a profound truth is another profound truth. And so it takes this idea of even when I fully believe something, it might be that there is something true and good in the opposite of what I fully believe.
Hi, listeners. Excited to share the second conversation of 2026 at the Play to Potential podcast. I'm your host, Deepak Jayaraman, and I help people play to their potential through my coaching work and through the content I create. Whether it is this podcast or the book Play to Potential that I published with Penguin about a year back, or some of the other online writing that I do. It's been about 9 years of the podcast, and when we started out, we were one of the few podcasts in India. But now I realize podcasting is a bit like what blogging was a decade back. And we've been reflecting on why we do what we do and what makes us differentiated. The why is that I see this podcast as a long-term journey of learning as a student of human experiences, transitions, and potential. And hopefully we'll keep marching as long as we can. What makes us different? Well, three things come to my mind. First is focus. We focus on three themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. We don't want to have an opinion on everything under the sun, but really sharpen the saw on these three themes. The two questions I'm curious about are how people think about where to go and how to grow. And in a way, sort of the summation of where to go choices is career, summation of how to grow choices is leadership, and transitions is everything in between. The second reason why we feel we are differentiated is miniaturization. I'd like to believe that we are the only podcast in the world where we break down a conversation into smaller nuggets and then reorganize the nuggets by theme so that in a world of abundant content, Play to Potential members are able to access contextual content, whatever you're seeking and whatever is top of mind. Go to playtopotential.com and see the curated playlist section to understand what I mean. The third reason we feel we are differentiated is sort of the HSBC tagline. I think global, act local. When I look at how we think about our guests, I feel we think about tapping into some of the best minds around the world, but ensure that the journeys we capture are local so that we're able to bring both the global thinking and the local application. And this we do across sectors ranging from business, photography, stand-up, music, sport, and much more. Thank you for your support over the years and look forward to your companionship as we move forward. My guest this time is Jennifer Garvey Berger, who I believe is one of the leading thinkers in the world in the area of how we should approach leadership in a messy, complex world. I first spoke to her at the podcast during peak COVID, where we spent time talking about the traps that we fall into all the time. Of the 100-plus conversations at the podcast, I would rate that in the top 5 in terms of the insight density of the conversation. This time, we go deeper into some of the elements of adult development and how we can develop greater nuance in terms of dealing with complexity, driving behavioral change, listening better, and leading better lives as leaders, parents, and in the other roles we play. Without further ado, let's dive into the conversation with Jennifer Garvey Berger. Jennifer, thank you so much for making the time. It's lovely to have you back at the Play to Potential podcast.
Thank you so much for having me back.
The last conversation we had, many of the themes we discussed, not being constrained by our past, listening to learn, I think I've sort of used them in multiple occasions, given it sort of, it comes up so often in the coaching work I do. So I'm really excited to dig into your latest edition of the book, Changing on the Job. Congratulations on the new edition.
Thank you so much.
Maybe just just to set context, Jennifer, if you want to sort of talk a little bit about the new edition, Changing on the Job, maybe the what the book is about and what the new edition is about, we'll sort of peel the layers as we go through the conversation. But I think that context might help the listeners to get a sense of what you've tried to capture through the book.
Thank you. So about 15 years ago, I started writing a book that was meant to make this idea of how do adults grow and change over time more accessible to more people, because it was a theory that changed my life and a set of practices that emerged from that theory that have changed the lives of many of the leaders I've worked with. And so the question was, how do we make that available outside of graduate school courses where mostly you could find these things? So I wrote this book and I published it. And then, you know, in the last couple of years, as the amount of complexity people are facing has just amplified ferociously, it seemed to me that it was time for me to take all the things that I had learned from and with my clients, especially over the last 15 years, and see if I could bring something that was, in fact, more user-friendly, more accessible, more up-to-date, had a wider aperture on, you know, both the theory and practice of how do we grow ourselves and others. And so that's what I've tried to do in this latest edition.
And in the earlier conversation we had, we did speak about the different stages of adult development, and you discussed that in detail, especially the transition points in this book. I'm just, before we dive into the specifics, I'm curious, why do you believe the link between adult development and dealing with complexity? What's the connect in terms of how we grow and how we deal with the even more complex world we find ourselves in?
Well, as we grow our internal capacities, one of the things that grows is our capacity to handle complexity. And so there's this idea in the world that things just happen, right? Complexity comes at you, and it's kind of like being in a rainstorm. If complexity comes at you, you just get wet, you know, like it just happens. But actually, there's a whole lot we can do, right? There's an enormous number of changes we can make, mostly to our inner state. We are not going to be able to change the dramatic shifts in the world. Climate change, AI, geopolitical strife, excuse me. We're not going to be able to have a personal effect on those things, but we can absolutely change how we metabolize those things in ourselves and how we use them as a force so that we can be surfing them as opposed to kind of bowled under by them.
And in the book, you use the term complexity fitness, which really stayed with me, Jennifer. We talk about different kinds of fitness, aerobic, anaerobic, strength, and so on. But and you say that there's a spectrum, and you know, and different roles requires different levels of complexity fitness. Can you just talk about the core idea here of how do you define complexity fitness, and maybe also, you know, what are the different, maybe even if you could take a couple of examples to say what could be a low complexity fitness ask from a leadership perspective and what might be a high complexity context, just for us to understand the nuance here.
Yeah, thank you. So I realize that we do understand this question of how do we get stronger and what is our strength? You know, people understand going to a gym, people understand, oh, last week I hurt my back because I was trying to lift something too heavy. We understand that injuries and discomfort happen when we are not fit enough to deal with the physical demands our life makes. But it's actually true that injuries and harm and pain happens when we're not fit enough to deal with the complexity of the world around us. It's a totally different kind of fitness. We have to think about it in a different way. And unlike physical fitness, it's pretty invisible to the naked eye. You have to actually really be searching for it. So to give an example, a pretty lightweight version of complexity fitness is, say you're a lawyer and you are asked to research the precedents for a particular case that you're on. Mm-hmm. You need to gather them, you need to say what they are, and you need to present them. Mm. That's a pretty low level of complexity fitness. And you can see that artificial intelligence can handle that kind of complexity fitness pretty easily, right? You feed it in, you say, can you synthesize this for me? And they can absolutely do that. It can absolutely do that. And so this is kind of like an entry-level complexity fitness. You might need to be very intelligent. You might need to be well-trained to do it, but you don't need to be able to handle a lot of nuance in order to simply report back something that you've seen. And as that increases, maybe now I want you to contextualize that for the current emotional space that people might be in. And I want you to make a recommendation based on kind of what are the emotional forces that are going through and maybe likely to be going through a jury right now. Well, that's a much more sophisticated task, right? It requires a lot more capacity to take people's perspectives, to synthesize across abstractions, to understand how people might be making sense of each other. It's way more complex a task than this first task that I've been talking about. And then if you are also going to try to say, in this piece, we want you to do all of those things I just said and create a win-win scenario. We don't want this thing to go to trial. We want instead everybody to leave, not feeling as adversaries, but actually strengthening their partnership. Well, that creates another level of complexity that is even harder to reach for, but something that we can get fit for.
Got it. And you touched upon it. It's very interesting. In a way, AI is sort of creeping up, and in a way, clearly does scenario one. And it's sort of beginning to show that it could take a stab at scenario two and three. And of course, I'm guessing the bar for humans, therefore, is to sort of keep, as the water level keeps rising, the bar for us keeps rising in terms of staying relevant. Since we're on the topic, how do you see AI moving the needle on complexity fitness requirement from humans?
I think you are so right. Right? I was reading yesterday, I read a new article out from Harvard Business School Press, and the number one use for AI right now is in people using it as a companion, somebody who listens or offers like therapeutic advice. The fastest growing use for AI is therapy.
Yes.
And there's a way that's good news because everybody could have a therapist in their pocket and the world is really tricky right now. Everybody could use a therapist. I get it. I like it. And on the other hand, I have a friend who's trained her AI as a companion to give her support. And so her AI says, you know, when her friends say, or when her colleagues at work say, I think you're really overreacting about this situation, she turns to her AI. She says, AI, do you think I'm overreacting about this situation? And AI says, absolutely not. You are completely justified in how you're thinking about this. And she's herself sophisticated. And so she has kind of a smile on her face when this happens because her complexity fitness is pretty high.
Got it.
But there are plenty of people who would then feel like, yes, I was right. My colleagues are idiots. And so the question for us is, do we really want to leave that in the hands of an algorithm and a large language model? Or would we rather have humans doing human work and machines doing machine work? And so the humans better get better at doing the human work so that the machines don't have us actually circling in our own traps, right? Our own little bubbles.
I was at a client site recently. I was talking to a venture capital investor, and I was just starting a piece of work. And I said, initially, I'd like to talk to a few people to sort of gather some feedback and get to know you from other perspectives. And I was sort of going along, and he pulled me aside and said, I asked my ChatGPT, based on the questions I've asked you, tell me a little bit about myself that I don't know. And it was about 80% there. So I was just asking myself, I think it's sort of, in a way, this raising water level is an interesting opportunity for us to keep raising the game and raising the humanness of what we do. And actually, maybe coming to that, Jennifer, how do you think about being human? Let's take this coaching context in the context of your friend, where the AI said, actually, you were justified, right? As a human being, as a coach, how do you think about amplifying the humanness and sort of in a way staying relevant as AI sort of makes strides in some of these spaces?
So I think we need to lean into what is it that humans are uniquely suited for. One of the things we've been trying to do and failing to do with AI is to tell the difference between how somebody thinks about something and what somebody thinks about. This is a really subtle difference, but it's basically the whole reason I wrote Changing on the Job, is to illuminate this difference. What you think about, the story, what happened, what your views are, that's one thing. And AI is really good at that. And humans are pretty good at it. How do you think, what is the structure of your reasoning? What is the way you make sense of the world? What is the thing that makes you uniquely you, not just in your history and your story, but in your blind spots, the way you are creating a representation of the world in your own mind? AI can't tell the difference between somebody who says, for example, I am super open-minded and I believe in diversity. And I think, I think it's incredibly important to lean into diversity. AI like takes that at face value. Yeah, you're super open-minded, blah, blah, blah. But then if you ask that person another question and say, well, how do you feel about people who aren't super open-minded? Oh, well, those people are wrong. You know, those people need to, they really need to work on opening their minds, and they need training and they need support, and, you know, they have all these bad things about them because they're not open-minded and tolerant of diversity like me. AI doesn't pick up on the fundamental thing that made you smile right then.
Interesting. Which is
that I can use words that say I'm open-minded, and yet just a little bit of a probe, and you see I'm only open-minded about people who believe about the world the same things I believe about the world. And I'm not open-minded about people who believe something different. And so that thing that you picked up in a second and it made you smile, we have not been able to get a computer to pick up on.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Got it. I think moving to another theme you discuss in the book, Jennifer, you talk about the self-transformed leader. Maybe for the purpose of listeners, it might just be helpful to just capture the five stages of adult development just to give them a sense. But I think the piece I was curious about was you say that the self-transformed leader meets the complexity of the world, not just with the mind, but with the entire being. And I was curious about that. And I think in the last conversation, I remember you also, we spoke briefly about the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern. And as soon as I read this, I remember you talking about her, and in a way that her image came to mind. But for the purpose of listeners, could you talk about the five stages and maybe just expand on this point about engaging with the world with the entire being?
Yeah. So these stages begin actually with childhood, right? And all of us can recognize these earliest stages, which is of a child who's still trying to figure out, a baby who's still trying to figure out what's me and what's not me, and how are we separated by our skin, right? Like an infant that cries when its caregiver leaves the room is not sure whether a piece of that infant has just left the room and won't come back, right? So this thing we call separation anxiety is actually this earliest stage of development, super well researched. Then over time, we understand that our skin separates us, right? We all get that. Like, you can leave the room, I'm still me. Our skin is different. But we sort of believe that our minds are still connected. And this is, this happens early in childhood. We're out of infancy. This happens early in childhood. It's kind of the first giant achievement, right? To understand, oh, our minds are separate, and I can be thinking one thing and you think an entirely different thing, and we aren't the same anymore. And that's a majestic achievement. And it also creates the conditions for me to be unable to, say, take your perspective. Like, I can know that you have a different perspective, but I can't really know what it is. You can tell me what it is. I can maybe hold it. It's really hard for me to hold yours and mine at the same time. And so I call that the self-sovereign mind, because it's like, I am the queen of my own dominion, but the only person in that dominion is me. I'm alone. And everybody else is a little bit of a mysterious to me. Then, and grown-ups can live in that stage, which is very black and white, very us and them, very good and bad. Grown-ups can live in that stage for decades.
Wow.
And all of us still have that stage in us, even if we've grown beyond it. It still exists. It's sort of like a house you add onto, and you still visit the original rooms from time to time, particularly if you're stressed or exhausted. And so this question of, can I take somebody else's perspective, is a question we should all be asking ourselves all the time. Can I actually take that person's perspective? Because it shows us kind of what room in the house we might be in. Then most people, most adults find this idea of just being like just me alone is too simple for the complex world in which we live. And so we tend to kind of breathe in some group. Maybe it's our profession, our religion, our society, our political beliefs, our family, our organization. But there's some larger group, and we take that in, and then that becomes who I am. And so I'm kind of being constructed by that group. Am I successful? What are my beliefs? All of those things I learn from that group. And I can be very sharply influenced, whether I'm a good person or a bad person, whether I'm a successful person or not a successful person, in what that group tells me about me and what I ought to be doing. And for most of human history, this thing I call the socialized mind has probably been the height of human achievement, because here I'm subordinating my personal interests to our collective good. And as long as there's some benevolent leader who can direct my attention, that's awesome. If there's an evil leader directing my attention, that's bad, right? Because now I'm still following you, and I don't have the kind of internal keel to be able to say, wait, that's wrong. And so I follow. So because that can be a little bit dangerous, sometimes very extraordinarily dangerous, in this modern world where you can't rely on the idea that there is some benevolent leader who can look after you and your and our best interests, many people, many but not all adults, start to move towards a place where they take that stuff inside, where they say, okay, I've taken in all these things from the outside, what my profession believes, what my workplace believes, what my family believes, what my religion believes, what my culture believes. Poof, I need to make up my own mind about those things. Mm. I don't want my story to be written by you. I want to write my own story. And so those folks, we call them the self-authored mind, those folks still take in all those perspectives, but run it through kind of an internal discernment system. And that internal discernment system is the thing that is their filter to the world. But then there's this one more step that most people don't notice. Pretty much everybody, by the way, understands intuitively these different earlier places that I've talked about. We've seen kids pretty much, like, there's a huge amount of self-help and leadership literature that's about kind of find your own true north, be the person you are, let them, you know, like all these ideas about like, let them be them and you do you. You find your inner leader. Those are all about the socialized self-authored transition. We have a ton of books written about that. And then there's one more transition that's well studied. There are potentially other transitions that are harder to study. There's one more transition that's well studied. And that's the transition where we say, huh, this self-authored discernment system that I've been working on for so long, actually, it's never going to be good enough. It's never going to be strong enough, powerful enough, take enough perspectives. It's never actually going to be enough. I'm not really by myself writing my story. Actually, my story is always co-authored because I'm in a society, I'm in relationships, and those relationships do shape me. I can't really overwrite them. And I don't really want to separate out totally. And so it's in this place where I can take and hold many perspectives and see the relationship to my own perspective and see all the shades of gray that connect them. So as we grow, we get more and more capacity for nuance and shades of gray, which is more and more capacity to handle complexity.
And in terms of the transition from self-authoring to self-transforming, would that be the last one, the next one?
Exactly. Thank you. Yes.
What do you look for? Are there examples even, you know, what does that bridge look like for us to move from the author self-authoring to self-transforming?
Yeah, that's a great question. The transition is one that most people don't make because they don't know it is to be made. So it's a tiny percentage of the population that actually begins to make this transition. So the first thing is to begin to notice, how am I making sense of the world? This is the first question. How much do other people's opinions have a draw on me or affect me in some way? This is an important question. How much am I kind of in love with my own views about things, my own way of kind of making the world in some way? And the question for the growth from the self-transforming to the from the self-authored to the self-transforming mind is kind of in the space of, how is it that other people who seem wrong to me might also be a little bit right? How is it that I could hold my perspective and open it a little bit, see myself more fully in other people? And how can I question both my own sense of certainty, which is important for a lot of us in all kinds of different ways, but also question, how is it that I've arrived at this sense of certainty, right? Like, how did I get here? And how could I open it to include other people, other views, other perspectives? It kind of takes very seriously the, I think it was Niels Bohr who said, the opposite of a simple truth is a falsehood. The opposite of a profound truth is another profound truth. And so it takes this idea of even when I fully believe something, it might be that there is something true and good in the opposite of what I fully believe.
It sort of reminds me of the work of Professor Joseph Badaracco in Harvard. And he talks about, right versus right. You know, very often he says when you're growing in a career, you're doing right versus wrong kind of decisions.
Yeah.
But leaders' role often is to do right versus right. And in a way, I'm guessing it's a little adjacent to what you just said, which is sort of how do you really navigate what seems right to you and what might be right by somebody else and find a path that makes sense in that context.
That's right. And how do you know that we need each other in order to do that?
Research actually suggests that about 1% of the adults around the world are in the self-transforming mind stage, about 35% in the self-authoring mind stage, and a significant 60% are in the socialized mind stage, give or take a few percentage points. In a way, a lot of my transition advisory work is often around helping leaders tune into who they are, what matters to them, what gives them joy, what makes them come alive, what triggers them, and bring these elements front and center as they think about shaping a life that matters and move from being in the socialized mind to moving to a self-authoring mind. I find that many of us see these as questions to address when we hit financial independence. But earlier we grapple with these questions and design a life that's fit for context, better the odds of us playing to our potential in a holistic sense. In a way, that's the topic of the book I wrote about a year back, Play to Potential, Lead a Full Life, Become the Best You. It's all about how we want to get to know ourselves intimately, inside out and outside in, and then go about designing a life that's fit for purpose, given who we are and what matters to us.
Now that you've spoken about the five stages, Jennifer, you say a self-transformed leader meets the complexity of the world, not just with the mind, but with the entire being. Can you talk to us about the insight here?
Yeah, I think that many of us, for most of our lives, approach the world through whatever our preference is. For most of the leaders I work with, it's the head, right? The capacity for intellect. I know surely that's my first go-to space, right? We want to think our way through, logic our way through, whatever that might be. And the self-transforming leader actually uses all of their capacities, their body, their intuition, their logic, their relationships. They're able to draw on the entire field of possibilities instead of believing in just one. You know, I have some clients who are very mind-centric. I have some clients who are very body-centric, like I always go with my gut or whatever that might be. The self-transforming leader uses the whole system of themselves.
And are there examples that come to mind? I know last time we spoke about Jacinda, I think we spoke around the COVID context when I think, they just had, an attack in a mosque, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And I know she'd shown exemplary leadership in that context. In the last few years, just to bring this to life, any individuals that come to mind that are displaying this kind of leadership?
I mean, I sometimes think of Satya Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft, as right. Somebody who displays these characteristics. I don't know him personally. So I have other clients I could talk about, but I won't talk about clients. But Satya, I don't know personally. I've only been in a couple of meetings with him present. but his capacity to take other people's perspectives and to look across a whole ecosystem and to not make people who are different from him wrong, I think is pretty sophisticated. And I think you can see with Microsoft what having a leader like that does to a company. So Microsoft was a company that was so focused on performance that their culture had really slipped. And Satya came in and focuses both on performance and culture. And it's that kind of and move that the self-transforming leader does automatically well. The rest of us can learn to do it well, but the self-transforming leader does it automatically well to look at the ands and not the ors of the world.
I had spoken to Jennifer when we were in the middle of COVID about 5 years back. Given the interconnectedness of the epidemic and the unknowns around it, she was musing about the kind of leadership we would need to move forward.
I think that leaders in the future will need to respond not to the short term, but to the long term. We're seeing that right now. Not to the disconnected, but to the interdependent. I think leaders will need to respond with their whole selves, their mind, their bodies, their emotions, and to the whole selves of other people, their minds, their bodies, and their emotions. And in a much clearer way, away from competition, which has often fueled humans and organizations, and into a deep sense of interconnectivity, because here we are all together, and trying to find a way for all of us to thrive is going to be every leader's job into the future.
And as you look around, Jennifer, any role models you see while it's still early? Any role models of leadership that you see emerging as you see different people deal with this crisis that's in front of us?
I mean, I have a bias here, but I am just finishing a blog today that highlights Jacinda Ardern, the Prime Minister of New Zealand, who has had to face more crisis in her time as Prime Minister than other New Zealand Prime Ministers have had to in many, many years. And I find her blend of clarity, humanity, and experimental approach, I find that refreshing and incredibly helpful and hopeful for what great leadership looks like in the future.
If you're liking this conversation and want to tune into Jennifer's perspectives on the five traps we could fall into that could impact our leadership, look up our earlier conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. She speaks about the trap of falling for simple stories, trap of being right, trap of agreement, trap of seeking control in a messy world, and the trap of clinging to our identities.
Moving to a different topic, Jennifer, you talk about the dance between the subject and the object at some point in the book. I'm curious about what this is and how that influences our transformation on the self-development spectrum.
So this is the this is kind of the core rep of complexity fitness. So this distinction, it's a little bit technical, but bear with me. There are a set of things that kind of drive us without our noticing it. They might be a belief or an assumption. They might be a piece of our history or a piece of our trauma. But anyway, there are a set of forces in us that are kind of controlling how we see things, and we don't know that they're controlling how we see things. And so those things, we say we're subject to those things. Those are things about the world that we can't examine. They're inside us and we're kind of fused with them. We're the same as them. And so we can't look at them. There's no separation between us and those things. My belief about, you know, a good person never gets involved in conflict, right? Is I just act that way. And I can tell you, I have this belief. but it's me. It's the same as me. I can't imagine a world where I could change or question or alter that belief in any way. I'm subject to it.
Got it.
But then we can move these things from being subject inside us, from our being subject to them, to them being an object of our reflection, right? Suddenly we can see them, we can take them out, we can look at them, we can make choices about them. And this move from subject to object is something that, you know, we commonly refer to as insight, right? We have sight into who we are and what we're on about. And with insight, the first step is we have to notice. And then we have at least the potential to do something different about it, to make a different choice, to have this belief or assumption steer us sometimes and not other times, to modify this belief or assumption. We've moved it to object and it becomes more powerful. We become more powerful once we have these things that we were subject to as objects of our reflection. And that move from examining those things that are driving us to putting them on the table and walking around them and making choices about them, that is the fundamental developmental move. And it's the fundamental wrap of our complexity fitness.
Very interesting. Now, in a different context, I came across this term, a break in transparency. The point being, very often we see the world with a lens, and we're not aware that we are wearing that lens. But once in a while, there's a crack in the glass. At that point, you become aware that actually, you know, there's an extra layer. And if you can sort of examine that lens separately, then your ability to see the world would be that much more nuanced. Would you say this is a appropriate description of what you just said, the subject-object dichotomy?
Perfect. It's perfect. It's exactly right. We don't even know that it's there and that it's affecting us and that it's shaping our worlds until it becomes an object of our reflection. And that crack often is the thing that lets us know there's something there. It stops, kind of that way of seeing the world stops working perfectly for us. And as it stops working perfectly, we have to do something different about it.
Is there, just to bring this to life, Jennifer, is there an example that you could share to give this a little more color?
Sure. So I was working with a leader recently, and her perspective is like a people first perspective. Right? She's a fantastic leader, incredibly devoted to her people, very senior in her organization. And she has this people first perspective, which is fantastic, except she didn't really understand all the components of that people first perspective and what she was subject to in it. And as we started to break it down, we noticed she had this belief that people should be treated with respect, with dignity. This is a great belief, right? Absolutely. And you wouldn't want to in any way like eliminate that belief. But she had specific things that let her know whether people were treated with dignity. Like so specific as she knew that you needed to give somebody a year to improve their performance under all conditions. They needed at least a year to improve their performance. And she didn't really know that she had that. She just knew that when people were given less than a year to improve their performance, she had the feeling that they were being treated unfairly and she needed to intervene in that unfair treatment, right? Without really understanding the componentry of that larger belief. And as we unpicked it and as she could put on the table the components of this people first belief, she could say, oh, there are some cases in an organization where somebody's performance is so badly affecting the organization's work that you can't actually give them a full year to improve. Like that's not going to work for the organization. And you have to balance organizational performance and individual performance in such a way to create a new, more kind of nuanced sense of fairness, which he could do once she started examining. She didn't want to have a rigid sense of fairness. She wants it to be fair, but she doesn't want it to be rigid. She doesn't want it to be hurtful to the organization, her sense of fair.
Right.
And so once she began to unpack that, she could see, I could replace this idea of like a year with the idea of like reasonable. And that's what we can do when we have something as an object, we can kind of edit it. She is never going to think an organization is treating somebody fairly if they give somebody no notice, right? She will never find that fair. And that's okay. But she needed a little bit more range than she had.
Got it. Fascinating. Rather than a binary state, you sort of operate in the gray. And
that's exactly right.
The simplest manifestation of this in my coaching work with leaders in India is around how a lot of them listen. A lot of us, I include myself when I say this, are products of the competitive context in India, where the premium was always to be the person who raised the hand first, or spoke first, or the loudest voice in the room. Very often, a lot of these leaders motor along and become a CXO, and then they struggle to listen without interrupting. They struggle to listen to learn. They often listen to win or listen to fix. And they struggle to recognize the limitations of how much they know or how little they know. Like Jennifer says, a lot of my work is actually involved in extracting some of these elements and placing them on the table for them to walk around and examine it and also realize how it is impacting their journey and effectiveness. This is one of those what got you here won't get you there kind of passages of play. I also notice that some of us learn through whispers, some through nudges, and some through a slap, which is the equivalent of a break in transparency that I was alluding to in my conversation with Jennifer. Something breaks, and then we go to the drawing board and start examining some of these elements. I notice that the smart ones build an awareness practice and are able to do this proactively without waiting for an event to precipitate this.
And from a development perspective, another phrase that stayed with me, I used to be a recruitment consultant with Egon Zehnder for 6 years before I came on this path of coaching. And I was trying to wear the hat of a search consultant in the context of discerning complexity fitness. And I was struck by one of the sentences in your book. You say that you need to often take people to the edge to evaluate complexity fitness. Can you expand on that? The notion of taking people to the edge of a certain stage?
Yeah, and this is not like to the edge of their tolerance, right? Like it's not that, as you just said it to me, it sounded suddenly unpleasant. Or like traumatic in some way. Taking somebody to the edge of their sense making is to ask them questions until they kind of don't know the answer. So I could take you to the edge of your content knowledge in, say, whatever, math or economics by asking you harder and harder questions about economics until finally you had to say, I don't know. Taking somebody to the edge of their meaning making is asking them questions about their meaning until finally they basically say, I don't know. And often that looks like, you know, we were just talking about this client of mine and her relationship to fairness. Often that looks like, what's the most important thing to you about fairness? And she'll say, I'm just making this up entirely, but she might say something like, the most important thing to me about fairness is that the best organizations, the best relationships are created under these conditions where we treat each other with kindness and generosity and a sense of fairness. I say, okay, that sounds great. what's the best thing about being treated and treating each other with kindness and generosity and the sense of fairness? And she might say, oh, the best thing is that people can rise to their full potential, for example. Mm-hmm. So, oh, that's great. That's fantastic. What's the best thing about people rising to their full potential? And then she might say, that's just obviously good, right? Like that's not a thing you could unpack. But she might think about it some more and she might say, well, I guess I have this belief that if a leader isn't helping people rise to their full potential, then they're not really doing leadership. So, oh, okay. And then what's so important about doing leadership, you might say. And you'll hear I'm basically asking the same question again and again to push to the edge. And eventually somebody says, my first mentor taught me this is just the way a person needs to behave. And if you're going to be reasonable, she was always really clear with me that this is what a leader did. And that's how I know. And so you can hear that's kind of externally referenced, right? It comes to me from this other person. I can tell you who it comes from, where it comes from, all these things. Or she might say, I've had 30 leaders and two of them were really excellent. And the thing that they had in common was these two. And I've done this research and I believe this. And then you can hear it's kind of more self-authored, more cobbled together. But you can kind of tell where that goes to.
I just love the notion of complexity fitness, the way Jennifer defines it. How contextual is someone's response? And how many layers of complexity can we hold before we hit a belief or a truth that's absolute and not contextual? I guess the onus is for all of us to build greater and greater depth of contextual adaptability before we hit a rigid wall in our operating system. The first step is just being a little more aware of ourselves. If this is a topic of interest, you might like a couple of episodes we did on the podcast where we connected the dots on external and internal self-awareness. You can just go to Play to Potential in any of the podcast apps where you consume this content and look for Connecting the Dots, and you should be able to see the episodes.
And I think just taking the role of a coach here, you also say that facilitating the transition of the coachee from one step to another requires us to anchor the bridge on both ends. We should offer an open and anchor the bridge. Once again, I found this intriguing. Could you expand on this?
This idea is taken straight from my long-term mentor, my dissertation advisor, my graduate school advisor, and dear friend, Robert Keegan. At Harvard. This idea has completely changed my life, right? Whether we're in a leadership space, in a coaching space, in a parenting space, the thing we have our eye on is where somebody should get to, right? Like, I wish you were more X, whatever the X is. I wish you were more generous, or I wish you were more able to prioritize, or I wish you were whatever, more sophisticated in your thinking, whatever that is. Mm-hmm. And we spend a lot of our time trying to get somebody over there through whatever our medium is, through telling or teaching or coaching or whatever it is. We spend our time trying to get somebody over there. Mm-hmm. And what we neglect is that people are unlikely to follow us over there if we're making their current place wrong, like their current capacities, their current way of seeing the world. If we make that wrong, it's like saying, I want you on the other side of the bridge, but not anchoring the bridge on this side. I think what we have to do is be able to see everywhere that people are today as like a coherent and fully functional, if not perfectly working, way of being in the world. And we have to have admiration for people's today. And then we have to figure out, you know, how do we help them feel the admiration we have and the understanding we have for who they are right now without trying to change or correct them or fix them in any way. And it's only once people have that felt sense from us, I see you where you are now. I see you, I receive you. It's only then that I think people would be willing to kind of step out onto the bridge and cross to a new place. Because why on earth would anybody step onto a bridge that was well anchored on the far end and not anchored on this end? To step onto that bridge would be very dangerous indeed.
And in a way, this is at some level linked to not being judgmental, I'm guessing. Just sort of accepting them the way they are and celebrating for whatever it is, but still sort of showing them the light on the other side of the bridge. And
Yes. I feel like the thing that we're going to, as we begin to deepen our practice in these adult development ideas, is to move from judgment to discernment. Right? How do we not look at somebody and say, "Oh, well, that's wrong. Well, that's naive. That's unsophisticated. Whatever it is, that lacks nuance." And instead say, I wonder what's going on for this person. And I wonder how well that works. How fit are they for the complexity of their world? If they're fit for the complexity of their world today, that's super good. That's super good. And if they aren't, then we can help them. But the first question is, how are they doing? How is their experience of their lives? Which is more important as a first question than our experience of our lives.
And it's also much harder work, right, Jennifer? I think the other thing I've, you know, come to realize is sometimes having these shortcuts and heuristics is often easier and places much lesser load on our minds and brains. So I guess this is why our brains do them.
And I love that you called it heavy lifting, right? Like all these activities that we're talking about here actually increase our complexity fitness. And so
this kind of metaphor of the weights. Yeah, exactly.
That's exactly right. This heavy lifting is well said. It's well noted. It's hard. And hard things grow us.
I love the point Jennifer makes about accepting people where they are before we get them to change, or try to get them to change, rather. I love the graphic visual of the bridge anchored on the far end, but not at the current end. Something similar came up in my conversation with David Bradford. He's been teaching a course around interpersonal skills at Stanford for more than 4 decades. He speaks about how this idea of accepting people the way they are is so crucial, especially in parenting.
For one thing, with kids, you don't label them. You focus on behavior, you don't label them. So let me give an example. When I was, I guess, 10, 12 years old, I still remember the instances. There were several times my mother said, "Well, David, the trouble is you're just lazy." Turned out to be a very destructive comment, because I said, that's who I am. And I said to myself, gee, if I don't work hard, I'm going to end up on the streets. And I saw myself as a lazy person had to overcome it. Well, anybody who knows me knows I'm constantly working. So that was a label. And when we label kids, they take it in as who they are. Now, if she would have said, you're having a hard time getting your homework done on time, that's a behavior. Then we could have done something. So I think we have to be careful about labeling. The other thing is we have to legitimize their feelings. So I have a story in which I'm not proud about, but I think it's very revealing. When my son was about 4 years old, 5 years old, he went down a slide and hit the back of his head in the edge of the slide. I was crying. I rushed over and I said, "Oh, Jeffrey, you're not hurt." And with tears running down his face, he said, "How do you know how I feel? Only I know how I feel."
Mm-hmm.
And he had me. He was right. What I should have said was, "I'm upset that you're hurting." But I was delegitimizing his feelings.
Mm.
And we delegitimize it all the time. We say, "Oh, you shouldn't be angry. You shouldn't, your older sister shouldn't be mad at your older daughter, shouldn't be mad at her brother just because he's now getting more attention." Well, she's mad. She's envious. That's the way it is.
Hmm. I was reading a book. Yeah, apologies. Huh? I was reading a book called Toxic Positivity, where it talks about this notion of not being present to the emotion that's emerging, but really quickly brushing it off with a positive emotion.
Yes. Yes.
You ought to be feeling this kind of thing.
Yes. What you're feeling is what you're feeling.
Mm-hmm.
I may not like that I'm feeling that way, but I'm feeling it. So I think as a parent, can we focus on behavior, legitimize our feelings, and can we also be open to our own feedback? Can we say, "Hey, am I doing something that's causing a problem?"
Whether it is parenting or moving somebody from a socialized mind to a self-authoring mind, I guess accepting people the way they are is paramount. I love how Jennifer frames this visually, securing the bridge on both ends.
Very interesting. I think picking up on one of the words you used, not trying to fix somebody, I distinctly remember in the last conversation, you spoke about various types of listening, right? You spoke about listening to learn rather than listening to fix or listening to win. In this book, I came across the term listen to be unsettled. I thought there was another layer which was interesting, which caught my attention. Could you expand on this notion?
We tend to listen to either hear what we expect to hear or hear something that we can correct and fix. We don't tend to listen for how could this conversation, this person alter me in some way? How could I come out of this different? And if we go in thinking, "Oh my God, this is like a very self-transforming way that we can adopt, we can borrow from the natural habits of the self-transforming mind." And we can say, "Okay, so how could we in this moment, instead of listening to reinforce our earlier beliefs, how could I listen to find something new or to challenge one of my own beliefs? How could I go after that and learn something new that I didn't have access to before?" And that question, I think, is also very, very helpful, gets us more fit for complexity.
I wanted to move to a very different theme, parenting. I have a 15-year-old girl and an 11-year-old boy. And I think in the book you discuss parenting and you said there's no recipe for success. What's needed is attunement to what is going on and the capacity to make the next good move repeatedly. Can you expand on this?
I think parenting and leadership have so much in common. Because I think that that's also exactly what we need as leaders. We can't control or make a particular outcome happen as parents with our children. No matter how much we would like to make them happy or successful or psychologically well or whatever it might be, we can't actually make that outcome happen. It's a product of too many interlocking, interweaving features. And so what can we do? We can pay attention to what's happening right now. So many of the mistakes that leaders and parents make is to look at the world as they wish it were, and then try to close the gap between the world they wish they saw and the world that is. You have a kid who's not doing their homework. You've always imagined yourself with a very diligent kid who always does their homework. And so you try to create the outcome of the kid doing the homework by, you know, first rewarding it or punishing it or, you know, forcing homework time or whatever. You're trying to make a particular outcome happen. But in both leadership and parenting, paying attention to what's actually happening in this moment and understanding that is so much more important than trying to get to some like predetermined goal. So then you say to yourself, okay, my kid is not doing their homework. And I have like done all these things. I know we've got the right setup. We made time for it. I sit with her and I try to help her. And still she's not doing her homework. What is going on there? And then to go into that question with curiosity, with a kind of an openness to understand, to ask her a lot of questions. What's keeping her back? What does she obviously not like about doing homework? Is this? And then to look at yourself, why is her doing homework so important to me? What do I think is going to happen to me or to her if she doesn't do her homework? You know, to examine these questions, it leads to a whole bigger set of options. Hey, maybe we enroll her in a school that doesn't focus so much on homework. Maybe we talk to her teachers. Maybe we figure out whether there's something that prevents her from doing homework. Like, instead of being completely focused on this one outcome, you can attend to right now and see if you can nudge things in a slightly better direction all the time.
Got it. Jennifer, the title of this podcast is Play to Potential. And in the book, you know, one of the things that struck me was you say that playfulness is the hallmark of a self-transforming leader. And to me, that felt like music to my ears. Can you, as we sort of move to wrap this conversation, how do you see the link between playfulness and potential?
I love the name of your podcast.
Thank you.
I think play is really underrated in our growth and development and in our work. The spirit of exploration, the spirit of discovery, the spirit of wonder that comes with play is how humans first learn to do everything, right? That's how we learn to do everything. And then we kind of put it down. But one of the things and we often put it down in a kind of a socialized way because the world says we're too big for that, we're too old for that, like grownups don't do that, whatever. But the self-transforming mind can make choices and understands that play is an incredibly effective tool for us to be able to be in the world in a different way. And an incredibly motivating way to explore and learn. So instead of having learning come as a kind of difficulty because we were bad or we should be ashamed of ourselves or whatever, which is often the way we kind of lean into learning at earlier stages. In this stage, it's just because the world is big and you're always bumping into things you didn't know about. You know, there's just always opportunities for that. And that like spirit of play makes everything lighter and makes our own transformation more possible.
I remember going to Billund, which is where Lego Group started in Denmark. And there was a quote, I forget from whom, who said that give me an hour of play with somebody and I will tell you what they're made of or their character or something to that effect, saying play so, you know, it tells you when you play with somebody.
It's so illuminating.
It's so illuminating, exactly. So, lovely. Jennifer, thank you so much for making the time for the second time on this podcast. We had these glitches, but I think the insights and the wisdom, I think, made up for all those glitches. Thank you.
It's life, right? We are indeed doing life as we're doing podcasting. Thank you for your wonderful questions and the spirit of co-creation.
Thank you.
And your deep forgiveness for Wi-Fi and dog challenges.
No.
We got it all.
It's all good.
I hope you found the conversation as meaningful as I did. There's something in her voice that I find extremely soothing and comforting, even when she is delivering the most unsettling messages. Three things stayed with me in this conversation. First, the notion of complexity fitness that she talks about and how we can discern it in others and how we can grow ours. The second is the idea of securing a bridge on both sides when we are trying to help somebody change. Third is the notion of attunement and the power of small nudges that compound over time. If you like this conversation, you will also enjoy my previous conversation with her, where we spoke about five different traps we fall into. While each of the five traps was super insightful, she specifically speaks about the trap of identity and the illusion of having arrived. Basically, we overestimate the changes behind us, but significantly underestimate the changes ahead of us. Just for that one piece of insight, you might find the previous conversation valuable. Do also take a moment to rate and review the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you consume the content. Thank you for listening, and look forward to having you at the subsequent conversations of the podcast. Bye now.